Today, with Boris Johnson's landslide majority and Jeremy Corbyn's heavy defeat, what now for Brexit, Labour and the country? And as Christmas approaches, we explore the hidden cost of the home delivery revolution. After watching Boris Johnson secure that landslide majority.
Hello, my friends. Good morning, everybody, my friends. Well, we did it. We did it. We pulled it off, didn't we?
Winning over dozens of seats that had been Labour for decades.
Sedgefield, of Bishop Auckland, of Stockton South.
And start preparing for an immediate Brexit.
I want everyone to go about their Christmas preparations happy and secure in the knowledge that here, in this people's government, the work is now being stepped up.
The Observer's Sonia Soda sat down to make sense of it all.
I honestly think this is one of the most difficult editorials that I've ever had to write, because there's just so much to process when there's a huge political moment like this. Sort of when I opened up my Word document to write, you know, I was just thinking, gosh, how do I sort of process all of this and summarise all of this in 1600 words?
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what to make of a reshaped political landscape. How did the Conservatives do this?
I think they did it by having really, really clear messaging and by deploying a strategy that was essentially about Boris Johnson running against the Conservative governments of the last 9 years. So if you look at their messaging compared to Labour's campaign messaging, it was just so much clearer and tighter. This was the Get Brexit Done election.
Let's get Brexit done, because we have to get on and deliver on the priorities of the people.
I think whether you voted Remain or Leave, actually, a lot of people out there in the country just feel like they just want this to be over. It's dominated our politics for the last 3 years. And then I also think, you know, if you look at the Conservative manifesto, it was so thin compared to the Labour manifesto. There's not very much in there. But there were just some very, very clear messages for Tory activists to tell voters about on the doorstep and for Tory ministers to draw on in interviews. And it was really simple. It was more money for hospitals, more nurses, more police officers.
And a lot of people are talking about the kind of men behind Boris Johnson, if you like, his chief strategist, Dominic Cummings, and Isaac Levido, who was brought in to run the campaign. I mean, they went around the country. They did an unbelievable amount of focus grouping. They highlighted previously Labour voting individuals all over the so-called Labour Red Wall, who they thought were persuadable. And they were pretty confident that they were going to win. The mood music this weekend is that they know now that they have to do everything they can to keep those voters. How much is that part of what they're thinking about at the moment?
I think it very much is what they're thinking about. I think you can really see it in the messaging and the briefing that's come out over the weekend, in what Boris Johnson has said, in some of the speeches he's given.
I want the people of the North East to know that we in the Conservative Party and I will repay your trust.
I don't think it's possible to overstate just how big a shift this would be for the Conservatives. The key thing for Boris Johnson and, you know, his new Conservative government is the changes that they're going to have to make to what's happened over the last 10 years. And I think that has very big implications, first of all, for the type of Brexit that Boris Johnson goes for.
Everything I do as your Prime Minister will be devoted to repaying that trust. And first of all, what are we going to do to get Brexit done?
He's got a lot of new MPs in Parliament now who represent working class areas of the country where manufacturing is pretty strong, whose economies would be really badly affected by a very hard Brexit where we're not aligned to EU rules and laws. So there's going to be implications for that. And then there's got to be huge implications as well for spending. And, you know, whether it's schools, hospitals, But also, I mean, take something like universal credit. The Conservatives slashed tax credits over the last 10 years. Low-income families with children, some of them have lost thousands of pounds a year in tax credits, which is basically what tops up your income when you're in low-wage work, when your job doesn't pay enough. I mean, thousands of pounds. And they did that while they introduced tax cuts, billions of pounds a year worth of tax cuts, most of which went to more affluent families. So really going to have to take a step away from that. 50% of families with children are going to be on universal credit by 2023. Loads of those are going to be new Tory voters living in new Conservative constituencies. And so I think if Boris Johnson is really projecting forwards and thinking about his electoral chances in 2024, he's going to have to do something very different to the politics of the last 9 years.
And to some extent, I think there is this sense of who is the real Boris Johnson? Is he the kind of more liberal figure who we saw run London for all those years? Or is he a more right-wing person who's desperate to deregulate post-Brexit? I mean, do we have any sense of that at the moment?
I honestly think Boris Johnson is whatever he has to be to win and to win power for himself. And the fact that he did win a whole raft of seats in the North and the Midlands from Labour, and if he wants to keep hold of them and keep a governing majority now, I think means that what he needs to do to win looks quite different to what he needed to do to stay in power before this election.
It feels like the fight on Brexit is over for Remainers. It's going to happen. But clearly, the trade deal is still there to argue about. And there have been some people suggesting that a bigger majority might allow Boris Johnson to go for a closer trade deal, maybe even more regulatory alignment, which the French President Emmanuel Macron was suggesting the Prime Minister should be my guest and offer.
Be my guest.
There's get Brexit done, and you're absolutely right, it's going to happen. But there is this big decision that comes afterwards, which is what do we want our relationship with the EU to look like? Do we want to be really aligned with the EU, close to the EU, or do we want to sort of shun that and be able to do trade deals with economies like the US, in which case our economy will start to look much more like a low regulation economy like the US, with fewer protections for consumers and workers? I think the reason why people think that a large majority means that Boris Johnson may tap to a softer Brexit now is because, I think one of the reasons why he went for a very hard Brexit that put that border down the Irish Sea was because he had to keep the Eurosceptic flank of his party on side. Now he's got a really big majority. The ERG have less power, but also he's got this new group of MPs representing a different type of area in the country that the Conservatives have sort of had represented in Parliament before. And those areas are going to be hit really hard by a hard Brexit.
Although I should say that there have been quite a lot of Downing Street briefings this weekend, and one of them suggests Boris Johnson won't change his position on Brexit and doesn't want regulatory alignment. We've also been hearing about his chief strategist, Dominic Cummings, who has long wanted to shake up the civil service and is planning on doing just that. Okay, deep breaths. Let's turn to the Labour Party. I mean, we've both been in touch with Labour MPs and defeated candidates over the weekend. Everyone has their own specific analysis of Thursday's calamity. Is there any agreement on what went wrong?
I think there are some common themes that come out through all the sort of blame shifting. Brexit is absolutely a theme. I think it's a recognition that Brexit is a symptom of much longer term structural issues for Labour, which is a disconnect with its kind of core working class vote in areas like the North and the Midlands, than something that just kind of landed.
The message in Stoke-on-Trent that's been heard by the voters is that Labour Party tried to stop Brexit.
So I think it's Brexit, and I think Labour was caught in a really difficult position on that. It kind of couldn't win whatever position that it went with. It was always going to lose some votes. Corbyn was a problem. I think voters just didn't see Jeremy Corbyn as a prime minister. I think there's also a consensus that the manifesto wasn't right, that it just contained too much stuff that was really popular on an individual level, like, free broadband and nationalisation of rail and water. But you don't get to win an election by collecting up a bunch of popular policies and sticking them in a document. People have to trust you to deliver them. So I think it was that. And then I think there's also a consensus amongst Labour ranks that the media played a role. And I think there's a lot of anger, actually, internally, that some people are sort of going quite out there and saying it's the media's fault. And others are like, that's just, sure, the media are, you know, have never been particularly pro-Labour, but that's not the right message after you've just lost massively.
And of course, that is a message that Jeremy Corbyn has given. He's written in The Observer. Tell me what he did say and what some of the responses have been.
The problem that a lot of people have with that article is he seemed to strike quite a defiant tone in it. So sure, he sort of apologised. Well, he said he takes personal responsibility. I don't think he used the word sorry in that article, actually. But, you know, he said our manifesto was popular. We won the argument on things like corporate greed and inequality and the climate crisis. And the tone that the article struck was, voters didn't quite get us, but we fight on because we're right. And I think that's why it's had such a negative reaction from people in the Labour Party.
There's a tweet, I think, overnight we can show from Harriet Harman about his apology. She says, "This shows no willingness to understand why UK Labour suffered this catastrophic defeat. Jeremy Corbyn should resign."
The problem is that when you've just suffered a massive election defeat in which lots of your MPs have lost seats, lots of really good people, when you've lost 2.5 million voters in 2 years, it's not really you who gets to say that stuff and make that analysis. You've got to say sorry. When you look at what the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, was saying yesterday morning, he did apologise.
Let me make it clear then. It's on me. It's on me. Let's take it on the chin. I own this disaster. So I apologise. I apologise to all those wonderful Labour MPs who've lost their seats, who worked so hard. I apologise to all our campaigners, but most of all, I apologise to those people who desperately need a Labour government, and yes.
He struck a much better tone than Jeremy Corbyn.
Lucy Powell, the Manchester MP, said people are just piling in on both sides, blaming Corbyn, blaming Brexit. In reality, it's both and much more.
Yeah, I think with hindsight, when you look at sort of what was happening to Labour's vote in working class communities, it didn't start to decline with Jeremy Corbyn. It's been a really long-term structural thing. So Labour was always going to have a leader that could construct a broad winning coalition like Tony Blair did in 1997. Not with the 1997 manifesto, that's not right for this time, but a coalition that brought together very different types of places, Labour voters in very different types of places with different attitudes towards saying that's the only way you can win under first past the post. Jeremy Corbyn didn't do that. He wasn't the man to do it. But just criticising him and saying he wasn't the man to do it, it doesn't get you very far in talking about, well, what is the offer that Labour can make? Who is the leader that can unite very broad, you know, diverse sections of the country, young voters in London with working class voters in Burnley, to, you know, get the keys to number 10? Who is that person, and what can they say to sort of bring those people together? That is a really key question for Labour now.
One thing that an election result nearly always does is it shifts the narrative. And the narrative for Labour a few months ago was people saying, why aren't you more Remain-leaning when it comes to Brexit? The narrative very firmly now is you've just lost so much of your heartlands. You weren't listening to your Leave voters. And that clearly is going to have an impact on who has the best chance to be the next leader. Tell me who's likely to be in the running.
We've got MPs like Lisa Nandy.
We've just had the most shattering defeat, where you really felt in towns like mine that the earth was quaking, and we've watched the entire Labour base just crumble beneath our feet.
Who was being talked about as potentially backing Theresa May's deal because she was arguing that Brexit had to be delivered in order for Labour to be able to have a conversation with her voters. We have MPs like Jess Phillips.
And I know that people like me because I have a personality, and that will never just be enough.
And Angela Rayner, so other women who kind of represent northern seats and seats in the Midlands. We've got a bunch of London MPs, David Lammy.
You have to reconcile areas like mine in London that are liberal and inclusive and outward looking with slightly more small C conservative working class communities in the north.
Keir Starmer, Emily Thornberry.
This duplicitous, gutless, reckless Prime Minister has been elected on one issue alone, wrapping himself in the lie that he is the only person to get Brexit done.
And then we've got Rebecca Long Bailey, who is being talked about as the McDonnell Corbyn pick, so the continuity candidate.
It was a very difficult election. I think it wasn't a normal election when we were just focusing on the main domestic policies that we normally would. Brexit certainly came into the mix there. We certainly pushed.
And then we've got sort of, you know, going back a bit, an MP like Yvette Cooper, who's sort of quite associated with, you know, the old Brownite wing of the party.
And it's interesting, Lisa Nandy is being talked about so much and already out there doing interviews. I mean, not long ago, Lisa Nandy, along with other then MPs who've now lost their seats or stepped down, Melanie Onn, Gloria Di Piero, Caroline Flint, were in this little group, and they used to tell me they were the group who were like most pro-Brexit in the Labour Party because their Leave voting constituents wanted it. And they said they were all in a WhatsApp group together and they felt completely ostracised from the rest of the party. That result on Thursday has totally changed that, hasn't it? It's meant that those voices that were saying, come on, let's think about backing Theresa May's deal, are really back in the game.
I mean, there are a lot of things that are going to make this conversation and this leadership election, I think, quite toxic for Labour. Like, after a defeat like this, it's never a nice sort of friendly contest. But I do think that one thing which will make the conversation easier internally for Labour is Brexit's going to happen now. And that means that actually people who kind of have really seen themselves as being on completely opposite wings of the Labour Party over the last 2 years are going to start to have conversations with each other again, I think. And so I think that's going to do an MP like Lisa Nandy a lot of good, actually.
There's a lot of focus on female candidates, quite rightly, because there are lots of good ones out there. And Labour has never had a woman leader. But one of the favourites is Keir Starmer. I guess one problem that he might have, similar to Emily Thornberry, or you mentioned David Lammy, is that they're London Remainers.
The reason why I don't necessarily rule out someone like David Lammy, for example, there, or Emily Thornberry, is just because it's the members who get to select who's going to be up next. We know the Labour membership is very Remain-y, so it's not out of the question that they could pick someone like that.
And the membership was very pro-Corbyn, so presumably a candidate like Jess Phillips, who has famously taken on Jeremy Corbyn, sometimes with language I suspect she herself regrets, could find herself having to do a really big job to persuade that membership. But I think one thing that's quite interesting about Jess Phillips is she's clearly incredibly charismatic.
She's massively charismatic. And, you know, she wrote in The Observer yesterday, and she herself said, you know, she took a different approach to sort of Lisa Nandy and Caroline Flint. She represented a strongly Leave voting area, but she was just up front with her constituents about what she thought, and she didn't lose very many votes. The reason why I think this contest is less predictable than many might think, there will be an anointed candidate. It's probably going to be Rebecca Long Bailey, but Rebecca Long Bailey isn't the most charismatic voice in the room. And I think Labour members care desperately about Labour winning again. And so I think if you get someone really sparky and charismatic who shares some of these members' politics, has a good analysis for why they're the person who can construct a winning coalition, I wouldn't rule them out if they're not the anointed Corbyn candidate. I think it could be more unpredictable than we think.
There's something that you've kind of mentioned that I think is quite hard to put your finger on in terms of leadership, which is what works and what doesn't. It's not necessarily something tangible. I mean, what is it that makes Boris Johnson so much more effective than Theresa May, or makes Nicola Sturgeon so much more liked than Joe Swinson? Why is it that Jeremy Corbyn absolutely tanked in leadership terms in this election? I mean, is there something that you can point
There's
to?
There's a magic, isn't there? There's sort of, it's like magic, it's charisma. I don't know what you call it, but it's being able to hold people when you go on TV or when you're in a room. You know, people look at you and they see someone that they believe can be a leader, and they believe can be a leader of the country. I think Boris Johnson is a dangerous charlatan, but I think he's got it to some extent. Some people believe him. They believe that.
Quite a lot of people believe him.
Yeah. And, you know, I used to work at Fred Miliband. I really like and respect Ed. I think
he didn't have the magic.
He didn't have the magic. I think Ed would probably say that himself. You know, he clearly didn't have the magic in 2015.
But am I tough enough? Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
I mean, I do think this decision that members have to make for Labour is such an important choice. And I really hope that they choose somebody who has that magic, not just for the, you know, 500,000 Labour members, but for the millions and millions of people who could vote Labour.
And one big, big additional headache for Labour is what has happened north of the border. I mean, the SNP have won 48 seats. Labour has been virtually wiped out of Scotland, apart from one remaining MP. Can Labour ever win a majority without Scotland?
I could see Labour being the largest party without Scotland, but a big decisive majority, it's really, really hard to see.
And what about Sturgeon? I mean, she's won this huge, huge majority in Scotland. Does that mean she has the right now to demand a second independence referendum?
It really strengthens the SNP case for another independence referendum. You know, the polls aren't decisive yet in terms of showing that Scotland is in favour of independence yet. So I think there is still an argument. You know, there was a once in a generation referendum, you had it, and the sort of movement for Scottish independence lost. But I think the argument will get stronger if the polls shift. I think the polls will shift if there's a very hard Brexit and Scotland says, you know, we didn't vote for this. I think that will definitely strengthen the cause for Scottish independence. And then I think it becomes very difficult. I mean, we've seen all this briefing from over the weekend again from Conservatives saying Scotland just isn't getting a second independence referendum. Well, I'm sorry, if in 2 or 3 years there's poll after poll showing that the Scottish people want it, if you know, the SNP do really well in the next set of Holyrood elections, you can't really deny people self-determination, or you can, but it gets you into very, very, very toxic waters, as we've seen with Catalonia and Spain.
You cannot hold Scotland in the union against its will. You cannot sort of just lock us in a cupboard and turn the key in and hope that everything goes away.
Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, we have nationalist MPs outnumbering unionists for the first time ever. A real blow for the DUP, who had the opportunity, like many of those Labour MPs, to back Theresa May's Brexit deal. I mean, Sinn Féin won't take up their seats, but how significant is that?
I think it is significant, and I think it shows kind of a slight shifting sort of balance in Northern Ireland. I think politics in Northern Ireland is not in a good place. The Stormont Assembly hasn't sat for a couple of years now. And Boris Johnson's withdrawal agreement, if that border was enacted down the Irish Sea, that rides roughshod over the principle of cross-community consent, which is this idea in Northern Ireland that politicians from unionist and Republican communities, there has to be a degree of consent between them to make change. There isn't that consent for a border down the Irish Sea. So I think if you were to see that happen, that starts to just really change the politics in Northern Ireland. It's quite hard to say exactly how. If there was a soft Brexit, I still don't think that that means that things are going to be all nice and rosy in Northern Ireland, because there are quite long-term problems. But it's at much less risk if we don't have a hard Brexit that sees a border down the Irish Sea.
Interesting stuff over the weekend about our voting system, because under proportional representation, Boris Johnson would not have got a majority. But he has got that. And there are people on the other side of this argument who will be very, very worried.
Yeah, they will be worried. And I think, you know, there are some really big things to worry about. There's the climate crisis. It doesn't feel like that's a priority for the Conservatives. And I mean, this is an existential issue for the world, let alone, you know, our country. So that's worrying, I think. I think on austerity, I don't see the Conservatives changing their approach to services that aren't universally popular. So things like, you know, services for vulnerable children, youth services, legal aid, all that sort of stuff. That's not coming back, I think. And that's really, really worrying if you're interested in fairness and equality in this country. And then I also think, you know, the sort of quite toxic takeaway from this campaign for Boris Johnson is that a Trumpian approach works. You can lie, you can try and blame things on your opponents that you're actually responsible for, and you can evade scrutiny by not showing up to set-piece interviews with a broadcaster like the BBC. And I'm worried that we're going to see the Conservatives really sort of, there's already talk about the Conservatives kind of, you know, not showing up to the Today programme because of they think it's biased. That would be very bad, I think, you know, if they change their approach to scrutiny.
okay, we've got one more week of Parliament before Christmas. What will they do?
So I think this week we will see a Queen's speech. I think it will be quite similar to the last Queen's speech, actually. But I think there'll be a very strong emphasis in there on stuff for new Conservative constituencies. And then we're going to see that withdrawal bill come back, and it's going to pass this time. This is a meaningful vote that really will be the meaningful vote.
And then we will leave the EU on January the 31st.
We will leave the EU on January the 31st, yes.
But then, as you've mentioned already, there will be an argument over the trade deal. But I kind of feel like for many Remainers, this wasn't only about trade policy. This was about what sort of country is the UK and do I feel like I belong to it? I mean, there is some truth in the idea that there will have to be closure now, that those emotional arguments will have to slip away to some extent.
Maybe there'll just be a bit of relief as well, but that you know, we don't have to talk about that anymore. We don't have to wrangle over it and fight about it anymore. I think there is now this big existential choice for us. Once we leave, what type of Brexit do we have? I think there'll be people making very strong arguments on both sides. But I sort of feel like it can't be as toxic and polarising as the debate that we've had over the last kind of year or two about whether we Brexit at all or not.
And meanwhile, however difficult it might be, a leadership contest in the Labour Party will be the beginning of a period of renewal.
Yes, I think it will be. I think it has the potential to be quite toxic, but I hope it won't be. And I think the fact that Brexit will happen will make it an easier conversation than it otherwise would have been.
Sonia, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
That was Sonia Soda, The Guardian's deputy comment editor and The Observer's chief leader writer. Parliament is sitting this week with dozens of new MPs arriving today. There'll be a Queen's speech and possibly a Brexit vote that this time will pass. Follow it all at theguardian.com. And there's a Guardian live event on January the 27th, chaired by political editor Heather Stewart, days before we're likely to Brexit on What Next for Britain. Coming up, Samanth Subramanian on who really pays the price for one day home delivery. Now, if you're not one of those smug, I did all my Christmas shopping in August types, home delivery can be a lifesaver. Over the last few years, it's revolutionised the way we shop, from the clothes we buy to how we get our fresh fruit and veg. But for writer Samanth Subramanian, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Ever faster home delivery has a real cost.
It's the holiday season, and we're all thinking about what gifts to get people, and more importantly, how to get them. Most of us have already left it way too late. And we know that we will eventually go online and order something that is delivered in a couple of days. And while we think a lot about the presents that we buy and where to buy them, we don't think quite as often about how these presents and these products reach us. There's no doubt that home delivery has significant upsides. Anyone who's bought a book that he or she couldn't find in a bookstore knows that. Anyone who's living in the countryside quite far away from other shops knows that the world can come to her doorstep. But we also tend to forget that free home delivery, two-day or one-day home delivery, has a cost. And the cost is not the 70-odd pounds that we pay for Amazon Prime on a yearly basis. The cost is invisible. It's out there in the world, inflicting itself upon the labor force, the environment, the cities that we live in, and even our own lifestyles and our habits. The efficiency of home delivery is built on two principles. The first is an intimate knowledge of us, of the consumer, of knowing what we're going to buy, maybe even before we know that we're going to buy it. The amounts of data that these companies compile on our spending habits and on our purchasing habits is immense. The second principle is the efficiency of the warehouse itself. If you have a tour of a warehouse in the Midlands or in the US, you will see vast, towering shelves of products and people moving with an urgency that never flags throughout the day. Because if the synchronization ever slips up, the entire process grinds to a halt. We can see the environmental impact of home delivery when we drive through a place like the Midlands in Britain, where massive warehouses and motorways and railway tracks and sheds have been built to fulfill our orders that we place with our moment's thought. And in the US every year, the cardboard from home delivery costs 1 billion trees. As our home delivery cycles get shorter and shorter, the pressure on our cities grows. The last mile of home delivery, which is the final journey that a package undertakes from its last warehouse to our house, that last mile is getting briefer and briefer, and the pressure that the vans impose on the traffic is intense. The premise of home delivery is that we don't spend a whole lot of time going out to get products, that the time we save by getting something delivered home can be more profitably spent with our families having dinner or finishing work or playing a sport. The truth is that's not always the case. The time that the internet's efficiency gives us, we somehow pay right back to the internet. We outrage on Twitter, we scroll through Instagram, we watch Netflix. But that's not the best use of our time at all, and that's especially true during Christmas, which is a time to spend with your friends and loved ones.
That was Sumanth Subramanian. My thanks to him and to Sonia Soda. That's all we've got time for today. But before we go, I just want to say a big thank you for some lovely reviews. Keep them coming. Or if you have any feedback, ideas, arguments, you can always tweet me at Anushka Astana. This episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.